From the campus of Maharshi University of Management, this is World Radio, KHOE 90.5 FM, and you're listening to the program Chat with the Dean with your host, Dr. Kathy Guarini, Dean of Faculty here at Maharshi University of Management. Welcome, Dr. Guarini. It's a nice time to be indoors on this beautiful winter wonderland in December. Who did you bring with you today?
Today we have Dr. David Lovell Smith. Dr. Lovell Smith is a governor of the Age of Enlightenment, but he is also a medical doctor with a lot of experience in Maharshi Ayurveda, and we'll be talking about some of his most recent research, the book he's written, and the book that he's about to write. So first I'd like to ask you how you became involved in TM. I understand you started practicing 40 years ago.
Yes, well, I was very fortunate because my parents, particularly my mother, was very interested in Indian things, and she got into yoga long before it was trendy, and she had a book on yoga, and I read this book and I started a few of the asanas, and it seemed to be doing something for me. And so when I got to university, there was a guy giving a lecture on transcendental meditation, so I went along and I was impressed. I wrote to my parents and said, well, is this meditation? It sounds pretty good, but they want to charge me $12. Do you think I should? And they sent me a check for $12 and said I could do a lot worse than that. And so that's how I got started.
And where was this?
This was in Dunedin in New Zealand.
Beautiful. And then right after that you became a TM teacher?
About 3 years later, yes.
And then you finished your medical degree?
After that I finished my medical degree, yes. I actually asked Maharishi what I should do because I was keen to come and help set up what then was Maharishi International University, and because I had a degree in music and philosophy at that time, and asked him if I should come and set up the music department. But he said, no, I should finish my medical degree. So it's taken me a little while to get back, but here I am.
And when you came back here, that was about a month ago, what have you been doing?
I've been teaching biochemistry to the pre-meds.
Ah, very good. Now, you also were one of the first adopters of Maharshi Ayurveda?
Yes, probably among the first wave. I think it was 1986 that I started, and went on courses in Australia and India, of course, and Italy, and started to use Maharishi Ayurveda in my own practice. We had a Panchakarma clinic for a while, and then carried on offering Maharishi Ayurveda to all my patients.
And what kind of results did you see?
Well, wonderful results, really, and it's so heartening when you find that you can give someone something quite simple and it cuts through all the complication that often surrounds Western medicine and treatment, and this very simple intervention can make people very, very much better.
And so what kinds of things were you doing?
Well, one of the things that I became fascinated with was a little instruction that Maharishi gave, which you could think was so obvious that you could overlook it, which is to eat when you are feeling physically hungry. And what I discovered was that a very large percentage of my patients were pretty vague about what it really meant to be physically hungry. And when I took them through a little routine to remind them of what hunger really is, it was often a revelation for people. And they started to feel very much better. The first patient I worked on was me, myself. And I found I was waking up feeling much more fresh and generally feeling better. And the food was tasting better because it tastes wonderful when you're hungry. And then I started using it with patients who are obese, the obvious thing to do if they're overweight, and found that some people were able to shed pounds very quickly. Not everybody, but some people. And in some cases, quite dramatically. And then I noticed that patients who had autoimmune disorders were getting dramatically better. The first case I had was a rheumatoid arthritis lady, and she had this quite severely, she was on prednisone, and they wanted to start her on gold injections, which is kind of the next heavy kind of treatment that you would give. And she had a lot of trouble struggling to get up the ramp of my surgery. And it was a long weekend. It was a Friday, and I said, well, could you just maybe just have light soup or not very much to eat until you get a feeling of physical hunger? And I described to her what that would feel like when it came. And so she went away over this long weekend and came back and said, you know, I'm able to turn the taps on in my house now. I couldn't do that before. And then a week later she said, I'm playing the piano. I haven't done that since I was a teenager. And so her joints in that very short time had dramatically improved, and she started sort of, you know, walking up the ramp at a reasonable pace. So I realized that this was something quite special actually going on.
So
here.
She had an autoimmune disease. Was she overweight?
She was a bit overweight, yeah, in that case, yes.
And what is autoimmune disorder?
That's when the body recognizes foreign material as being foreign and tries to attack that, but then the body's own tissues get caught in the crossfire. So it's a wide range of disorders, including rheumatoid arthritis, but also things like inflammatory bowel disease, where the body attacks the bowel, or Graves' disease, where the body attacks the thyroid. But the general thing is that the body is attacking its own tissues, uh-huh, mistakenly. So the immune system has become confused. And what's fascinating is that although the immune system seems very distinct from the digestive system, we know, of course, that the body is very much as a whole, and it seems to be a very strong link between a faulty digestion and what's called a pro-inflammatory state, which is where the body is chronically inflamed and attacking its own tissues. So I can tell you about some of my other star patients.
I'd love to hear these stories, because it seems like such a simple thing for people to start doing, even
yes,
though I guess I would like to hear what it means to be hungry. Some people think they're hungry all the time. Whenever they see food, they know they're hungry.
Yeah, and one of the first things that I realized is that there's a difference between the desire to eat and actually feeling physically hungry. Mm-hmm. And so you can think, oh, you know, I could really use some food now, I could really eat, I really feel like eating, I know I'm hungry. But when you go into it, there's nothing really there. Or there may be something else. Often you mistake another sensation and think that must be hungry, you know, it must be hunger. I had one patient who was actually a long-term governor and a very capable businessman, and he was adamant that he was feeling hungry, and I was very suspicious, because he, you know, I just didn't, I had a feeling that he wasn't somehow. And so on the first session he said, no, I feel an empty hollow sensation, because that's my criterion, an empty hollow sensation in the just at the below the rib cage there, in that soft part below the rib cage. And he said, no, I definitely have that. And so over the course of about three sessions we went into it, are you sure you're getting this? And on the third time he came, he said, oh, no, actually, it wasn't. And he said, I've realised what it is. It's actually a feeling of anxiety. I actually feel quite tense there. And, you know, why am I feeling tense after all these years of meditating? I know what it is. It's because my parents didn't get on very well, and meal times were a time of great stress for us. And so I always felt tense at meal times, and I thought that was hunger. And I've always thought that that was hunger. And when you asked me what hunger was, I knew that hunger was an empty, hollow feeling, so I told you I was feeling empty and hollow. So it wasn't until that he actually found out what was really there that he realized all this. And so it's awareness. It's coming back to the body and becoming aware of what is really there, as opposed to what we thought was there.
And so this one experience with rheumatoid arthritis was pretty impressive. Some of these other disorders, have you had similar experiences?
Well, I can tell you about one of my star patients, and of course I'm telling you the very best patients, but this boy, we can say for sure, would be taking very nasty drugs now if it wasn't for Maharishi Ayurveda. He came to me at the age of 14 with his parents. It was a meditating family. He was complaining of very severe abdominal pain, diarrhea, and passing blood, which is very serious, of course. And I sent him to a specialist and took some blood tests. And the blood tests came back way high, something called the CRP, the C-reactive protein, which is a measure of inflammation. Mm-hmm. I like to think of it as a measure of sick. It's how sick you are, really. So if it should be less than about 4, and in his case it was about 54, so it was really high. And the specialist diagnosed Crohn's disease, which I thought it was probably was, and the specialist advised him to go on prednisone immediately and some other very potent anti-inflammatory drugs. And then he went out with his football friends and had some alcohol and had a pizza or two at midnight and got really sick and came back to see me the next day. They couldn't find the specialist. He was out of town. The parents were desperate. And they said, can't we do anything from Maharishi Ayurveda? So I thought, well, you know, he has learnt to meditate. He hasn't been meditating for a while, but he could get back into his meditation. And then he could go on a pitta pacifying diet, because pizzas aren't the best. And then the most important thing I said was this thing about, you know, explaining to him what it was to be really hungry. I said, when were you last hungry? And he said, oh, I can't remember, it was a long time ago since I've felt that. Well, what do you get? I just get pain, and I eat when I get the pain because it makes the pain go away. So I said, well, it's not, do you think it's a very good idea to eat when the body is in pain? Because maybe that's telling you that that's, you know, something's wrong there. And he said, yeah, that's logical. So long and short of it is he went away and didn't eat for some time. I told him to have just light soup at meal times if he wasn't feeling the empty hollow sensation. And as soon as he did feel the empty hollow sensation, then he should eat. He must, because that's his body telling him that it's ready now to digest. So anyway, he hasn't had any bleeding since that moment, and this, we're going back 5 years now. He's been in complete remission. His CRP came woof down like that, and it was less than 4 for the next couple of weeks. And the diarrhea went away over the next week or so. He gets the odd bout every now and again of diarrhea and pain, and then we bring him in, and we find that he's drifted off a wee bit. And so we remind him, and the CRP goes up to about 8 or something like that, and then it comes back down. And the other day we did a sensitive CRP, which is where they can test whether it's how much below 4 it is, and it was 2.6. So I was very pleased about that. I did actually, I told another Crohn's sufferer about this, who was in the paper, because she became a dietitian because she was convinced that there must be some way she could heal her Crohn's. So she trained to become a dietitian, and she's been looking at every which way to help her Crohn's through diet. But she didn't know about the hunger, eating when you're hungry thing. And I told her the story I just told you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, 8. If I could get mine below 20, I'm feeling, that's a good day if I can get my CRP below 20. So I don't think it's just the diet. I don't think it's just the pitta pacifying diet. I think it's this, the body likes to have food when it's ready for it. And when it's ready for it, it'll tell you by getting this empty, hollow sensation. It gives you that signal. That's the body's intelligence. It's telling you that it's ready now. And we must trust the body's intelligence and listen to it.
And then how do you know when you've eaten enough? I mean, there's a tendency for some people to get hungry and then just eat everything inside.
Well, there's two things here. One is that you know if you've eaten too much because you get bloated and it feels uncomfortable. So uncomfortable is not good. It's not natural. If you feel a comfortable, satisfied, contented feeling, I would say that's time. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've discovered is that it's very much easier to know when you've got to that point when you've started with the empty hollow sensation, because then you've got a benchmark. You know where you are. You can feel that empty hollow sensation going away, and then as it goes away, up comes the feeling of contentment, and then you say something like, boy, that hit the spot, and you feel like you're replete. Whereas if you start without the empty hollow sensation, you're kind of all at sea. You don't know where you are, and you go more by taste, actually. So tastes become more important. If you're not getting that lovely feeling of the empty stomach becoming nourished and filled. And so there are studies which show that obese people are much more conscious of taste, and that's why they become gourmands or gourmets?
Gourmands,
yeah.
Yeah, both.
Because they become very much into taste, and they distinguish between the different flavors and so on. Uh-huh. And of course, that just encourages them to eat more as well.
Now, we know there's a lot of other Ayurvedic guidelines about eating. For example, not eating late at night, or not eating when you're anxious, or not eating standing up, and all of those things. Now, what if you're hungry and it's 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock? Or what if you're in some other situation where Ayurveda would not recommend eating, but you feel hungry?
Yes, these are very good points, and these I intend to put in a book that I'm writing at the moment. And that's what we have to counsel the patients about. If you are hungry after about 7 p.m. because you've been, you know, thinking, oh, I mustn't eat because I haven't got the AHS, the empty hollow sensation,
yeah,
that
yeah.
is, then I would say just have hot milk, really.
Uh-huh.
Hot milk.
Uh-huh.
And then it's another situation where you've decided that you might just wait on breakfast, and then it's 10:30 and you get hungry and it's kind of awkward. What should I do then? Well, then you could just have a snack, maybe some fruit. But what I find is that when people start doing this, at the beginning their eating's a little bit kind of all over the place, but then it very quickly settles down to being the three meal times, or maybe two meal times. And so I'm not saying eat any old time. I'm saying eat at the three meal times and make sure that the hunger will be there. And so you get to know how much to eat at breakfast time so that you'll be hungry about noon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to know how much to eat at lunch that you'll be hungry at around about when you've finished your program, you know. And it becomes a kind of you get into the kind of the swing of it.
Beautiful.
Now, Dr. Raju, who I asked about this because I wanted to make sure I was on the right lines, he said that we should eat something at every meal time. But that something might just be a cup of hot water.
Yes, well, we love our hot water in this town. Now, you recently completed a PhD, and your dissertation was on regulation of eating.
Yes, this is what I've just been saying.
What were the main? I mean, you know, obviously it wasn't anecdotes; it was some study. What did you find overall when you looked at a number of subjects?
This thesis that I did was a theoretical thesis, so I wasn't reporting a study that I had done. It was a theoretical paper, and I was going into the history of hunger, really, what studies have been done, and the confusion that has arisen over what hunger is. And it was fascinating. I found that Shakespeare mentions hunger in Twelfth Night.
And what does he say about hunger?
The Duke in Twelfth Night is a swaggering, sort of arrogant man, and he says that, I wish I could quote it to you, but he says that in essence that his love is far greater than anything that Olivia could be a him. He's in love with Olivia, you see. Mm-hmm. And because a woman's love is, it's a bit like, he says, it's like savouring food. It's not deep. It's just something of the senses, you know. But his is, mine is always hungry as the sea and can digest as much. So he makes the distinction between the desire to eat and hunger, which is very interesting that Shakespeare would have thought of that. But then you can probably just about find any idea in Shakespeare.
And so are the modern studies on hunger, do they have anything to do with people eating when they are hungry?
Oh, no. You see, the modern studies on hunger are bedeviled by this philosophy of behaviorism, which is that you don't ask people what they're feeling because feelings aren't important, and you just look at their behavior. And so if you see someone eating, then you know they're hungry in the modern mind. And, of course, I mean, they could be eating because of habit, they could be eating because of emotions, they could be eating for all kinds of reasons. And the studies up until very recently have used what are called visual analog scales. So you have to put a mark on a line from 1 to 5, you know, how hungry are you feeling? Not hungry at all, very hungry indeed. And you put a mark somewhere in between the two, which could mean anything, you know.
Huh, don't ask about the... And now I've got the lingo, EHS.
They don't ask about the empty hollow sensation, no. And so, but then when I went back into it, I found that Walter Cannon, the great physiologist, he knew all about that. He called it the hunger pang, and that's what he was studying. And so it was very interesting to see how blurred the field had become and how very much in need of clarification it was. So that was what I was doing in my thesis, trying to clarify that whole area again.
And the book that you're going to be writing, can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's going to be called Your Hunger, Your Health, Your Happiness. And it will be all about what I've just been describing to you. Yes. And with many case studies and so forth of my patients, stories of my patients, and how they have benefited from what's really a very simple piece of medicine.
Right. And I understand it's not just for obesity. It's for many other things.
It's very good for obesity, but also many other things as well. And diabetes. I haven't mentioned diabetes, but I think these things are all related, you see. If you're eating too much, and we do eat too much, and mostly in our very food-rich society, then we put ourselves at risk of insulin resistance, and that is associated with chronic inflammation. So that's the tie-in, I think, between eating badly and these autoimmune disorders that I've been studying.
Now, what about these other kinds of eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia? They must be hungry all the time.
They are. There's a fascinating literature on it. One study showed that when these girls were asked whether they were hungry, before the experiment, they said no, they weren't. And when the experiment was going on, they kind of got them thinking or more aware of themselves, and it turned out they were voraciously hungry. And so it's all I believe it's all to do with awareness again. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a fascinating area. There are people from different disciplines converging on this idea. So this idea of eating when you're hungry, it's been around. And, well, Shakespeare had it. But in the 1940s, there was a psychiatrist named Hilda Brook, and she was very interested in this area in relation to anorexia. So she talks about learning hunger, and her theory is that when we're children, we never learn properly what it is to be hungry because we're fed too much all the time. And so I think this is a field which is about to really explode wide open.
You're listening to KHOE Radio 90.5 FM. This is Kathy Guarini, and I'm here with Dr. David Lovell Smith, and we're talking about eating, actually. We've been talking about Ayurveda, but somehow we've landed on the topic of eating. He's an expert on eating. And, you know, we've all just spent, oh, maybe a month of just eating and eating and eating. And you said to eat only when you're hungry. Now, what happens in holiday seasons when you're tempted by all kinds of things?
Well, you know, I think we can be very easy with ourselves. It's not that we can never eat a lot again. In fact, it may even be quite healthy. I'm thinking of the Kalahari Bushmen, who they may go, you know, 3 weeks without eating, and then when they get a kill, they gorge themselves, and they have special straps which they put around their bellies to hold themselves in. But then they may go a week or two again without eating. So I don't have any problem. You make sure you're hungry before Thanksgiving or before Christmas dinner, and then you have a good blowout, and then but then you may not want to have the next couple of meals because the hunger's just not there. So you just, it's kind of a self-referral, self-correcting kind of system, really. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes complete sense. In fact, anything else doesn't make sense. And I'd also like to hear about this, your first book, which I understand is at the MUM bookstore. It's called Perfect Blood Pressure. And what motivated you to write that?
Oh, well, I had seen the studies by Robert Schneider and others, and I'd had many successes in my practice of people being able to bring their blood pressure down just by learning transcendental meditation and getting into a good Ayurvedic, Maharishi Ayurveda routine. And I thought more people should know about this. And so I started to write this book. The other thing that concerned me was that the pharmaceutical companies were getting away with, I call it carpet bombing the population. They were, and they still are, drugging the many to save the few. So I think it's.
And what do you mean by that, especially with reference to blood pressure?
Well, you see, if you have high blood pressure, say a little bit high, it's above the range that's considered to be normal, chances are actually that you're probably not going to have a stroke, but you are at greater risk. You're at a greater risk. So if there's 1,000 people in that situation over a year, maybe 6 people would have a stroke. But that means that, you know, all the rest didn't. And the philosophy behind the drugs is that we'll drug all those 1,000 people to save, maybe 6 people would have had a stroke, and then maybe only 4 people would have the stroke if 1,000 people take the drug, you see. So
and then the side effects, what would they be?
Yeah, well, all those 1,000 people have to suffer all those side effects. Mm-hmm. For nothing. It hasn't done them a blind bit of good, actually, because those people weren't going to have the stroke anyway. And so this seemed to me there's something not right here. But then you can write it up, you see. You've got 6 people who would have had the stroke, only 4 people had the stroke. That's a 30% risk reduction in stroke, which is very misleading. It's what's called a relative risk reduction. Mm-hmm. It's only 2 people, actually, out of 1,000. So the absolute risk reduction is 0.002, which is not that great. It's good, but, you know, if there was some way we could go to those 2 people and take their pulse and find out that they are really at risk and treat them, that would be, it seemed to my mind, that would be a much better way to go about things than drugging all these other people who weren't going to have the stroke in any case.
So now, what about, I know meditators who have high blood pressure, mm-hmm. and they feel like they're having a good routine, and they are meditating, maybe their siddhas, and yet they find they have high blood pressure. What can they do?
Well, they should have their pulse taken, and they should look at every avenue of Maharishi Ayurveda and Maharishi Jyotish, because, you know, there is some imbalance there. And it's good not to have an imbalance, and they'll probably feel better inside themselves if they don't have that imbalance. But that's what I would do if I had that, if I was in that situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And keep monitoring, and if necessary, if it's dangerously high, then of course you have to take the drug. I'm not anti-drug if it's needed. So follow the advice of your physician. And if it's dangerously high, then you must take a pharmaceutical drug. Otherwise, or while you're taking that drug, then look at every other modality you can think of to get it down.
Now, I've heard of something called white coat syndrome.
Yes.
What on earth is that?
Well, this is the first thing I address in the book, because the fact is that a high percentage, maybe 10, even 20% of people who are diagnosed as having high blood pressure only have it when they're in the presence of their doctor. So that's why it's called white coat hypertension. I don't know why we doctors have such an effect on people.
And does it have to do with the white coat if they're not wearing a white coat? Yeah. Do they still have it?
I think it depends on the manner of the doctor.
Do your patients have that?
I do have one or two patients with that, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they can't explain it, and they feel quite embarrassed about it. And I get them to take their blood pressure with their own machine at home, and maybe compare their readings. And every time they come and see me, I say, look, what is this about me? I'm really quite a nice guy, you know. I don't But it's a sort of cultural thing, I think. I'm going to the doctor, you know. And so one of those patients we've elected not to treat, because it's so clear that any other time his blood pressure is fine. So there are a lot of people.
And maybe the recommendation was, don't go see the doctor.
Yeah, that's right.
If you want to keep your blood pressure low,
you want to stay healthy, keep right away from that doctor.
Oh, God. Who would have imagined that there would be diseases like that?
But what it means is there's a lot of people walking around who are taking these drugs who don't need to be. Yeah, because of that. So the first thing is to find out whether you really have got hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
Buy your own machine. Don't get one of the wrist ones. They're not accurate. But you can get one that blows up the cuff around your arm. And they usually about $150 to $200. You want to get a good one like that, and that will give you quite an accurate reading at home. Yeah.
I have learned quite a bit today. Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure.
And I am really, really looking forward to this book on what you said, eating skills.
Yes, eating skills.
I love that term. And are you going to be doing more research in that area?
This is what I hope to do, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, get some formal studies up. Mm-hmm.
And I hope you also come back to MUM in the future.
I'd love to come back to MUM.
Thank you very, very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Kathy Guarini and Dr. David Lovell-Smith, for this very delightful chat on the merits of healthy eating, Ayurveda, and the connection between the two, which is one of the topics of Dr. Lovell-Smith's newly published book titled Perfect Blood Pressure. Dr. Lovell-Smith will have a book signing for his new book at the Argyro Center Bookstore on Thursday, December 30th from 12:15 to 1:30. Thank you for joining us on the program A Chat with the Dean here on World Radio KHOE.